This is the I Read Comic Books podcast, the very best podcast for regular comic book fans. I'm your host, Mike Rappin. Joining me this week, two clones created by Mr. Sinister attempting to swindle a baby out of my loins, Brian Murray.
Hi.
And Nick White.
I think this is an X-Men reference.
Yes, yes, thank you. For all the people out there, I do watch the X-Men TV show. Thank you to Kyle on the Discord who reminded me that a new episode came out, so I just watched the newest episode. Very interested to see where the series goes, but we're not here to talk about X-Men. We are here to talk about comic books, which is tangentially related.
We're not here to talk about X-Men, but we will at some point.
Yes, I'm going to be bringing up X-Men at some point, but we are here to talk about comic books. I'm very excited to talk about comic books with Brian and Nick today. So I'm going to ask the two legally mandated questions that I have on every single episode. That is, how have you been? How have comic books been? Let's start with you, Brian.
I've been pretty good. I spent most of last night spreading Managed Democracy with our dear editor, Xander, and another friend. Playing Helldivers 2. It's become a bit of a problem. It's one of those games where, like, you tell yourself, yeah, I'm just going to do one or two more missions, but each mission is, like, 30 minutes long. So you sit down to play at 9:30 and look up, and it's 1 o'clock in the morning. And then you have to do your prep for the podcast in the next morning instead.
Right.
So I did that by getting up a little earlier than I wanted to and reading Life is Strange, Forget Me Not, number 2. This is written by Zoe Thorogood, art by Claudia Leonardi, and colorist by Andrea Izzo. This is based on the Life is Strange True Colors game. In the first issue, our main characters, Alex and Steph, found a weird little kid who had the power to take people's memories away. Meanwhile, Alex, our main character, has the power to read and manipulate emotions. And so they have this kind of immediate bond. And these two can't just leave this kid in the middle of the road. So they, of course, take her with them on their school bus turned tour bus for their two-woman band. In this issue, we've gone from just introducing the characters to each other to actually trying to address this girl's trauma. Mm-hmm. Because she has essentially been collecting negative emotions from people in an attempt to do a good thing for them, right? Like, if she can take away the memory of your pet dog dying, then you won't be sad about your dog anymore.
Right.
But now she is sad about your dog. And so she has just been, like, accumulating these negative experiences over time. And that does exactly what you'd expect it to do. Fucks the kid up.
Yeah.
Jeez.
So I think I read this issue. I think we did an episode a while back where we were like, hey, let's read a book that the other person likes or something. And I think we'd all decided on reading Life is Strange. And I feel like the question of, like, where does this line up in the continuity was a thing. Like, I'm looking at some preview images right now, and I think from the first issue, I remember this being, like, really bonkers. And I think you answered the question that I think I was sitting on at the end of that issue, which was this girl, like, she takes away the memories, but she absorbs them, and they don't just, like, go away from the ether. They're just transferred to her. Does she have, like, a way to, like, remove those memories, or is it just, like, we have to just, you know, help you deal with your trauma in, like, conversation and yada yada yada?
Yeah, she can get rid of them, but only by giving them back. And So this we have begun the journey of them, like, traveling the country, because essentially Alex and Steph are in a band and they're on tour, and so they're just taking this girl they found in the street with them to try and bring her back to places where she can dump off these memories. And so in this issue, we find them going to this guy who had a really toxic relationship with somebody online and was basically hung up on her and couldn't get over it. So this little girl had, like, there's this horrifying moment where this girl is like, I'm Connor, I'm 21. It's like, you're not, you super aren't.
Yeah.
I don't know what your name is, but you're 10. So they have to go back and find Connor and, like, talk to him and give him his memories back. And in doing so, kind of, like, help him process these thoughts, these emotions, because he is, like, it's kind of like he's in a place now where he can actually deal with those experiences. Mm-hmm. And so it's borderline therapeutic. Weird to have a tween doing it.
Sure. Yeah.
Your therapist should not be a child. Just gonna put that out there. It's kind of interesting. I'm not sure how much of my enjoyment of this series is just coming out of a fondness for the characters of Alex and Steph, mm-hmm. because I really liked them in the game. And if this were just like an original property, I'm not sure if I would still be following it. It's not bad in any way. Mm-hmm. It's just like there's not a whole lot of meat on the bone, you know?
Gotcha.
How many of these games have there been at this point? Like, have they been regularly releasing games alongside of these, I guess, media tie-ins? Or is it just like, I think last time I heard there were like maybe three games?
There's four total, but it's kind of weird because they're not like direct sequels to each other. Like, right. they live in the same universe. Mm-hmm. But like there are two story or two games that follow the Arcadia Bay crowd of Max Caulfield and Chloe Price. And then Life is Strange 2 follows a couple of brothers on the run from the law. And then Life is Strange True Colors is Alex and Steph in Colorado.
Okay.
I think True Colors came out in 2020, 2021, maybe? I don't remember. Okay. It came out sometime in the morass that is the last 5 years.
yeah. Sure.
And so Titan has been publishing, if I'm not mistaken, they've published a couple of these series so far.
Yeah, I think there's like six volumes of the Life is Strange comic before this.
Gotcha.
And that's all following Max and Chloe from the first game.
Gotcha. Okay. So this is like their first foray into like a new, like different characters that the comics have done before. But
yeah,
okay.
As far as I know.
Okay. Well, how are you liking this book? I guess now two issues in.
It's good. I mean, I love these characters, so I'm always happy to get more content from them. There's a little bit at the end of this issue where Steph is talking about her backstory a little bit to this new girl, and mm-hmm. she went to high school with Chloe from the first game. And so we have this like nebulous connection back to those characters. And because Life is Strange is such a like choice focused franchise, mm-hmm. to make this content, they kind of have to collapse the waveform down into one universe where set things happen.
Oh,
right.
And
right,
so
right.
It's kind of interesting to see like what choices were made in this continuity.
Okay. I this is like when I think Knights of the Old Republic, right, has like a bajillion choices, but for like the Star Wars canon, like they had to be like, well, the canonical choices are this happened, exactly. This happened, this happened, and that happened. Right. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense. That's always so weird when they have to like be like, well, we've got to actually make the choices for you now for canon's sake.
If we want to write a book about Darth Revan, we have to decide who that is.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair.
I don't even want to open that can of worms statement that you just said. Maybe we'll save it for the post credits. I just
20-year-old spoilers.
Yeah, 20-year-old spoilers. But okay, well, do you think you're going to keep reading this book, Brian, then? I guess, I mean, you know, I know you said there's not a lot of meat on the bones, but you're still like into the story.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's not filling, but it is tasty. So
I see. Well, you know, we all like cotton candy sometimes, even if it makes our teeth hurt. Nick, let's move on to you. How have you been? How have comic books been?
You know, I've been fine. There's not a whole lot to do. We're sort of at that point in Michigan still where like every week you're like, I think this is the end of winter. I think we're done. I think we are moving on to spring. Plants are going to grow and et cetera. And all the other things that I've been told happen when spring happens. And, I am not sure we're there, and I've already seen snow reports for Tuesday, so here we go again. not much else to report, I'm afraid.
Well, thank you for the West Michigan weather watch. We appreciate it, as always.
People need that. Mm-hmm. People need that. But sort of to piggyback off of Brian's topic, I've also picked a franchise book, and also kind of brings up that very interesting question of, like, do you read books just because they're part of a franchise and the quality is or isn't there? I don't know. And I think that's a discussion we can also have for my book, which is what if Aliens number one, this is of course the fabled established Marvel What If franchise. They're carrying it over into some of their other properties now beyond their Marvel universe, superheroes, mm-hmm. whatnot. This book has a whole boatload of credits, which is always a good sign that A, you're at the big two, and B, you're maybe just about to get, you know, wholesale fucked over, but we'll get to that in a second.
Sure.
So we begin with a concept credit, folks. We're not talking about a plot credit. We're not talking about a writing credit. We're talking about a concept credit. And I think people read the credit pages of your comics because for some reason, I don't know if there's some law, some weird draconian law that you're not allowed to lie on the credits page, but you will see some very curious choices sometimes. And concept is usually what I refer to as the 2-minute Mike Mignola phone call, although usually he gets a like plotting credit, I think, or even like a story. I think a story credit is technically what he gets.
Yeah.
We don't have a story credit here. We have a concept credit. I don't know what amount of involvement that truly means. We'll double
somebody
back
in
to this
a meeting
in a second.
Going, dude, wouldn't it be crazy if?
Yeah, Nick,
right.
Nick, go into your thought process
here. We'll double back here because
you've got a lot of preamble. You got a lot of preamble. Keep going.
I have a lot of thoughts on this.
Okay.
Unfortunately. So the concept is by Paul and Leon Reiser. That is Paul Reiser of Stranger Things and Mad About You, and Aliens fame, fittingly, obviously. Leon Reiser is apparently his son. The concept is also by Adam F. Goldberg, Hans Rodionoff, and Brian Volk Weiss. Adam F. Goldberg is the creator of the TV show The Goldbergs. I'm serious.
Okay.
And Hans Rodionoff is his writing partner. I don't really remember what's going on with Brian Volk Weiss. Writing by Hans Rodionoff and Adam F. Goldberg. They have done other books for Marvel. I checked. Art by Giu Villanova. Colors by Yen Nitro. Letters by Clayton Coles, cover by Phil Noto. My too many people on a book sense is tingling, and it's one of the reasons I don't read the big two as much anymore, because you see this a lot. That said, I have seen a couple of interviews. I've seen a few tweets out there. I do genuinely believe Paul Reiser does seem to care about this book. He's definitely tweeted a couple things, and either he genuinely cares, or it's possible that, you know, this man's, you know, occupation for his life is as a performer, and he's just convinced me. Okay. But you know what? Great performance in Aliens. I will give him the benefit of a doubt.
Totally.
We'll move on from there, because I do think, like, he's stepped up and advocated for this book and advocated for local comic book shops and a couple other things. And I don't believe it's just him writing his name on the back of a check, and just the fact that maybe his son wants a writing credit, and this is a whole J.J. Abrams' son wants to write Spider-Man again situation, because we do not need that again.
Yeah.
This book is almost certainly better than that book. So there is a nice outline page at the beginning of the book for those who don't have the plot of Aliens memorized, or for those who haven't seen the film, although kind of the whole conceit of this book is to deviate from the source material,
right?
So I don't know how many people are reading this without that primary source, unless you're Danny, who confessed to me that not only had he not read Aliens, uh-oh, not seen Aliens, but that he had also had seen, I think, every other Alien movie, hadn't seen Aliens, and then proceeded to read this book. I'm not shaming you, Danny. I just thought that was funny.
And we love you, Danny.
To deprive people of that humor is just an injustice.
I will say that I have seen Aliens, but it has been a solid decade at least.
Sure.
So I really appreciated that recap. I also read, this was almost my pick as well until I got into the notes and saw that Nick had chosen it.
Mm-hmm.
But so this, I mean, how Mike, what is your feeling on spoiling a 35-year-old film.
Here's the thing. Everybody in their podcatcher of choice has timestamps that we put show notes. We're going to put out a full warning here. Full spoilers for Aliens if you haven't seen it. And then we can move forward. So skip ahead if you don't want to be spoiled.
Okay. So for those who don't remember the plot of Aliens, Paul Reiser plays a character named Carter Burke. And he is a company agent. He's basically the corporate babysitter for Weyland Yutani. And the military is sent in to investigate the disappearance of this colony on this planet. He's basically brought along because in the Aliens' future, obviously, large-scale government and large-scale corporate entities have formed a really weird, fucked-up bedfellows sort of, hybridization.
Not like the real world at all.
Yeah, very different from the real world.
It's a real... I know some of you will have to really wrap your head around this idea, but I'm sorry. So he's basically brought along as the babysitter. And then plot twist, we find out that more or less he's been sent there with a directive to bring back, xenomorph material, whatever the cost may be, the ends justify the means, blah, blah, blah. He finds it and he's trying to bring it back to the point where he basically leaves Sigourney Weaver and Newt to die. They confront him. They decide they're going to kill him. And then the power goes out. He escapes and he comes face to face with Xenomorph and cut to black. We don't know what happens.
They became really good friends and they just skipped through the wasteland of the planet together.
Right. Exactly. And so this book basically says, what if he survived? What are the implications of that? And honestly, I don't even know if it's so much of a deviation from Aliens as much as it's a pretty plausible kind of explanation for what really could have happened that would actually pretty convincingly exist within the canon that's already there. I think that's the crazy thing about it. It sort of fits. And it actually sort of provides an interesting connective tissue between Aliens and Alien Cubed or Alien 3, however you want to call it. And actually sort of makes the events of the beginning of Alien 3 make more sense than they currently do. It's weird. It actually works really well. And for people who were pissed off with how Alien Cubed begins, this actually kind of smooths that over a little.
God, one day, Nick, when we're going to have to I'm going to have to feed you scotch or something and have you give a drunk Aliens timeline history. I would just love it. Because I feel like there's so much that you're not saying right now just because I know you. And I know that there's a lot to be said about Aliens.
There's a lot.
I feel like I've seen a lot of these movies and don't necessarily know how they connect. I just go in saying this is going to be a good time. I shove popcorn down my gullet. So there's definitely more to be said, but continue. I'm throwing out that to the universe to see if we can maybe make that happen in the near future.
Okay. Yeah. We'll put it on the schedule.
Sign up on Patreon. You can commission episodes. That's all I'm saying.
Exactly. There we go. Exactly. But yeah, people who were really upset with how Alien Cubed sort of hit a reset button of sorts. I'm not going to spoil two movies here, folks. I feel like this actually works around that. So obviously in this scenario, Burke survives and the book jumps forward 35 years, which is kind of funny because it's been 35 years since Aliens. And so it jumps forward to, the quote unquote present. And maybe that makes it easier because they don't have to try to age Paul Reiser, in one weird way or another. They just take modern pictures of Paul Reiser and they go, well, this is what he looks like now, which works. But yeah, Burke is now stuck as this mining operation manager. He is stuck in some stupid ass office where they talk about, file folders and how they hate Mondays. And basically he becomes a scapegoat for the events of Aliens. And then the book sort of takes a weird little twist and suggests that maybe things are changing for Carter Burke. I think the value it provides in terms of the story content for Aliens and Alien Cubed is interesting. I think it's actually, like I said, really pretty clever in the way it weaves those stories together. What I'm worried about is where this book goes, because I have no freaking clue where they want to take this from here. Art-wise, it's kind of a weird middle ground between your Alex Ross realism and like your Riley Rossmo hyper-stylization. It kind of splits the difference and maybe leans a little bit more towards realism, but it's really loose realism. Mm-hmm. So I think some people are going to have a problem with this book's art. Sure. I think it's fine. I think the color work is great. I think it's just very loose, you know, imitations of real live action, you know, real people. Sure. And I think, yeah, some people will probably find that it splits the difference a little too much, but I think it's fine. And I think as this book moves forward, unless it has more reasons to continue doing flashbacks, which maybe it will, but it feels like it did all of that already.
Yeah.
There won't be those moments where you go, okay, like, this is what Sigourney Weaver looks like in my brain. Is that what Sigourney Weaver looks like on the page? You know, those sorts of comparisons will go away, as maybe Paul Reiser's character will be the only one, you know, the only one that you have to kind of, you know, check your, you know, brain idea of, you know, Paul Reiser versus the page. So
yeah, it worked for me in the same way that a lot of the Star Wars ones work for me, where like,
yeah,
it doesn't necessarily look like Mark Hamill, but it does look like Luke Skywalker, you know, like.
Yeah, for me, it was like comparing to like Salvador La Roca, right?
Well, I was wondering if his name was going to come up.
On the La Roca scale, who has also done alien art already.
Yeah. I knew this was going to be here. I knew this was going to happen. Go ahead.
This is a... I woke up at 2 a.m. in the morning and the earth was shaking. It was a 4.7 on the La Roca scale. This is, I would say, is actually looser than La Roca, which is maybe weirdly less disturbing, because like La Roca gets like 92% of the way there and it's like really close, but it's just not perfect.
Right.
And this is looser than that. So maybe if your hang up is the Uncanny Valley, this doesn't get close enough to where I would consider it Uncanny Valley. It's not that good.
Yeah, I'm looking at the art for like some of the preview pages and stuff. I definitely see what you're saying, that like, in going along with what Brian was saying, where there's like this, oh, this isn't a picture perfect realistic like Luke Skywalker or Mark Hamill, but this looks like Luke Skywalker. Like if I squint at Mark Hamill and squint at this art, I get the same vibe, you know? So like, while there's like the page that I posted in our Discord is like, there's Sigourney Weaver, like her character Ripley, but like, I'm like, yeah, I recognize that it's not exactly Sigourney Weaver, but it is Ripley when I think of like the outline of that character and the facial features and like the things that make Ripley look like Ripley. Right. Yeah. I think, and that's what's important, is you get the vibe, because I think we've all read licensed books where like the characters that are drawn on page don't even remotely resemble the actors or like the characters on the show. They don't have to be picture perfect exactly, but they kind of have to have the same like shape and feeling and presence. And I feel like some artists don't nail that. This artist definitely does.
Can you get the core features right? The essence. Can you get the essence right? And yeah, I mean, I do want to clarify, when I said it's not that good, I'm talking on a realism scale, not qualitatively, because honestly, I will, and I know this is going to make a few people mad, you know, fuck them, I'll take this over Alex Ross. I'll take this over Salvador La Roca.
Oh my God.
And I know Danny is probably clutching his comic book somewhere.
No.
But I feel like he gets the core features well enough, especially on, I mean, the page you posted, Mike, like that looks like, you know, that looks like Ripley to me 100%.
Yeah.
So yeah, overall, if this was a one shot, I think this would be you know what, honestly, thinking about that now, this would have made actually a pretty good one shot. Mm-hmm. I honestly think this book, beginning to end, and the way they end it, it leaves the door open. I think this would have been a really interesting one shot, because I don't know which one of these people, maybe all of them, had some pretty good ideas about how to weave the second and third movies together. And it would have been fine. So that's the only nervousness I have is like when I read what there's four more issues, there's three more issues.
Three, I think,
I'm like, yeah, I'm like, okay. Where are you going to go? I don't know. We'll see.
I have one. Maybe this is like a wild conspiracy theory that I want to run past you, though, Nick, is do you think there was actually anybody in those cubicles he was walking past? Because I don't think there was.
Well, you find out later, right, when he's in the park, that the park is actually a holographic projector.
Yeah,
you
he's on a mining asteroid.
Right. And he has to remind everyone that they're mining this very rare mineral, and he's a very important man, and, you know, he's not that convinced himself.
But then he says that it's also, like, almost spent. Like, there's almost none of that material left.
It's an interesting idea, and you certainly the holo projector part of it later... And I didn't even think about that at the time, but that's a good point. How much of the rest of that could have been projection-based? Yeah,
because to me, that would also explain why his daughter was so fucking pissed at him. Like, if he just dragged her out to the middle of nowhere where there's nobody else.
Yeah. It's...
Well, now I got to read this freaking comic book, and you guys put so many questions in my... I hate every time I fucking sit down to read alien comics. I hate reading these, and I like them. I'm going to move on. I'm going to move on because we got to get through the rest of the show. I read a comic book as well. Yesterday I spent all day at Legoland with a 5-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 9-year-old, and my wife Kelly and her sister. We went out there as her nephews and stuff.
But these kids are completely unrelated.
Just random kids. Just grabbed some kids off the street, and then we went to Legoland.
We
went to Legoland all day, and it was very exhausting, but very fun in the sense that the kids had fun, and that's all you can do as an adult is hope that the kids have fun at Legoland. It is not a place for adults. Do not recommend going there as an adult. This is not Disney. This is not any kind of theme park that allows for adults to have fun. This is for children to have fun. That's it. That said, I had fun because the kids had fun, and that's it. And I bought a cool little Lego bonsai set. So that'll be fun to put together. I mostly bought it because it's the set that has the leaves that are green, but then you can turn it over to be like the cherry blossom color, and they're made out of little frogs. And it's so funny to me. My nephew, when he saw that, he could not get over it. Like, he was losing his mind. The 7-year-old kid almost falling on the ground laughing because there were pink frogs that go on a tree.
I thought you were just desperately like seeking inner peace after the whole day at the park. No, tree was just okay.
There's more to be said about that, but I'll save that to talk about offline. But
save that for therapy.
I'll save that for therapy. But I will say I read some X-Men books this week. I got caught up on Marvel Unlimited now that it's been 3 months since I like canceled all my X books, and now I'm reading them. For the people out there that are actually listening to this podcast, I do read X-Men books still. But still, I read those. It's weird to be caught up, but still be very behind. So, like, I'm not completely caught up on, like, the Fall of X stuff, but I am as caught up as Marvel will let me be. But anyway, so that's interesting. I got some other thoughts about that. But I do want to talk about a different book that's not an X-Men book, and that is The Displaced, number one. This is written by Ed Brisson, art by Luca Casanova. I'm going to butcher this name. Luca
Casalanguida.
Casalanguida. I said this like four times before I started reading before I started recording and whatever. Colors by D. Cunniff, letters by Hassan Otsmani Elhow. The summary of this book is in the city of Oshawa, Ontario, a handful of people are coincidentally brought together after their city mysteriously disappears into a strange sinkhole in the night. How does a city housing 200,000 people suddenly disappear? Why does one old man claim that this has happened numerous times before and no one remembers? Some folks on the Discord were talking about this book. I like Ed Brisson's writing. I liked his work that he's done on some of the X-Men books out there. So I figured, like, let's try this out. I feel like some of Brisson's independent books are very hit or miss for me, but, you know, you got to keep trying because some of them do hit. For me, I think I was very unsure about this book going into it because I'm usually not one for a story about, like, people suddenly thrust together due to a massive unexplained phenomenon. Like, Lost was not my type of thing. The 100 was not my type of thing. I've tried all this stuff. It never really works. But I figured I would give Ed Brisson a chance. So, I don't know. All I can say about this first issue is sometimes it's nice to have a story that doesn't really hide its details outside of the synopsis that you get from the publisher. Like, the pitch for this book is exactly what you get out of this first issue. There is no like red herring. There's no like any hidden lines. There's nothing you really need to read into. It is what you're going to get on page. And I appreciate that. but that also means that the first issue kind of feels like you already know what happens, right? Because the first issue really only establishes the characters, really gets us to the big question at the core of the book that you know from the synopsis of the story. Boom, I think, does a bit longer. Boom Studios does like a bit longer synopsis that kind of gives away the premise. But the idea is not to get you in just for number one. It's to hopefully get you in for the whole series. And I think that by the end of this issue, even though I knew everything, I did like that the characters that we met, the story that Brisson kind of creates with all these like very different, very colorful people, bringing them all together under this like big question mark at the center of the story is at least interesting enough to get me into number two. And I will say, the art on this book is very solid. It's a little blocky, and it's maybe a little, I don't know, it's maybe something that folks would say is not like, I don't know, attractive in some ways, because it does feel kind of blocky, kind of messy. But I will say that some of the issues, or some of the pages in this issue, have like these beautiful full page or double page spreads that allow the weight of like the serious changes that are happening in the story to really press on you, and they force you to kind of slow down. Because I think overall this book reads really, really fast. It reads in such a way that you're like, if I don't get to this next page, like I'm going to scream, because every page introduces something new and opens up another box with questions. And Brisson does a great job of getting you just to the cusp of answering something before introducing a new thing, so that by the end of the issue you're sitting there with a bunch of questions that need to be answered in a way that doesn't feel like an Image comic book number one hook. It just feels like a really good like pilot television show. And I don't mean to completely compare this to TV, because there are a lot of TV shows that have done stories like this, but I think Brisson does the right thing in this book and answers almost nothing by the end of the first issue, but still keeps you interested because of the character dynamics that we establish in like just one-off back and forth conversations. So I don't know, I'm hesitant to say that I love this book, but I am definitely curious to see where it goes, because a story like this, it like I said, it could be compared to a dozen other like Oops All Mysteries tales. Like again, a Lost comes straight to mind, but Lost sucks, and I feel like this one doesn't. So I really want to see where Brisson like takes this story and allows him to like stretch his legs to see like, is this going to be a 5-issue miniseries? Is this going to be like a 30-issue story? Because I could see it going a couple of different directions in that regard. So I'm game to at least try issue 2, even if it means that I'm picking up another comic book, despite my attempt at curbing myself from buying new comics in 2024. Every once in a while, you gotta taste a little bit just to see what's out there. And here I'm trying something to see if it goes anywhere, but I'm still holding on to that feeling of like, if you're not getting me by like issue 2 or 3 or 4, like I'm done with you. I'm just dropping you. I don't care. I don't care if it gets better at the end. Like, you really got to keep me going. I feel like this first issue at least gave me enough hope that there's some actual like legs to this book. So, yeah,
you can only edge Mike so long.
Oh,
is,
man,
that the title of the episode? I don't know. Is that too? The last thing I'll say is, you know, this is one of those off the beaten path books that I think Boom, we see put out every couple of months. They try these books that are like not sci-fi, not fantasy, not all ages, not bright, not shiny, not a boombox book. They're kind of like these darker books, like Matt Kent's Grass Kings is one of those books where I'm just like, this does not feel like it should sit alongside of a bunch of their licensed stuff and whatever. But yet Boom consistently keeps doing this, because I think that they, when they believe in a book, they're going to push it as equally as they do all of their other big books. Obviously the licensed book get a little bit more push because they probably got like a bit more marketing budgets from the partner companies that they work with, or just because they know that they'll sell better. But nonetheless, I like that Boom hasn't like cut off these types of books yet, because I think that they could just lean like and double down on licensed properties and like all ages books and OGNs that are, they know are going to sell, but instead they keep publishing these types of books. And I have to respect that, because they have a lot of competitors, right? Like AWA, Mad Cave Studios. I also read a Mad Cave Studios book that was actually pretty interesting. I rarely try those, but that's, we'll save that for later. Image Comics, obviously Dark Horse, all doing these types of books. And yet Boom still is trying to like compete in a space where like I think other publishers are sometimes doing it better, sometimes doing it worse. So I don't know, I'm just happy to see that they are continuing to do this types of stuff, because I don't know, every once in a while you need something that's a little bit different than what Dark Horse consistently puts out or what Image consistently puts out. Because like I said, this first issue doesn't end with the same type of hook you would expect from those publishers, and I really appreciate that, like that change of pace.
Yeah, I think for better or for worse, Boom is still years and years later trying to sort of shake that mantle of all ages franchise books, which, I mean, sure. You know, I don't know if you want to say you're doomed by your own success, but I think that they had some real success with those early on in their first couple of years. And like, despite the fact that they've put out just a wide variety of books, they're still just associated with that.
Yeah.
That's why Mike is still the X-Men guy in our heads, despite the fact that he reads so much other than X-Men. But like,
yeah.
Can't shake
the first
it.
Thing we all learned was, oh, Mike likes X-Men.
Yeah. Everyone is just one note. Nick's the aliens guy. I don't know. I'm not going to type.
I defy classification.
Yeah, I won't do it to everybody else here. I'll do it to Nick. But let's
right, we'll classify Brian now. Brian thinks he's not in this thing. So
Brian's the Star Wars guy. All right, I said it. I'll do it.
That's fair.
Well, let's move on though. Let's talk about books that are on top of our pile, comics that are new or old, or just something you're trying to read off of your shelf, or in my case, something that literally just came in the mail yesterday. But before we get into that, I want to shout out some of the folks hanging out with us on Discord. As always, you can check our show notes. There's a link to our Discord. You can come talk comics with us. It's like, maybe, as I've been told by a handful of people who've joined the Discord with a lot of worry in their hearts, maybe the most welcoming comic book conversation community that they've ever been in. So just throwing that out there, if you're not a part of the Discord, we highly recommend it. A lot of really lovely, fantastic people there. But folks that are hanging out with us today, they're reading next. CK is reading Ripple Effects by Jordan Hart and Matthew No. Kate's going to be reading Portugal by Ciro Pedrosa. Paul's going to be reading, of course, Judge Dredd Origins. And Avocado Kenobi is going to be reading Batman Dark Age number 1. Look at vast array of wonderful people. It's so great. But let me kick things over to Nick, what is on the top of your pile this week?
Look, there's just a faint preamble here. Like, I don't want to, I mean, we just talked about Nick being the alien guy. So following, doubling down with another alien book, I realize is, I contain multitudes, you fuckers. And
okay, cool. Brian, what's on the top of your pile?
So I just want to say, I did also read a couple other books. I read the first two issues of, what is it, The One Hand by Ram V. Mm-hmm. I have some thoughts on that, but I just need to really let that percolate a little. Okay. But I've been interested in that. I would briefly say, if you're looking for crime noir, I think it's a good place. Apparently that book is interconnecting with Dan Waters' book, yeah. The Man with the Six Fingers.
Nick.
And I got all confused this morning because I thought maybe it was one book that ended up getting renamed the other book. And then no, they're two different books and they're interconnecting because the two of them share an office and they're collaborating on it. So
the top of Nick's pile is a corkboard and some red string.
Yeah. So, for those looking for a crime noir, kind of weird retro futurism world building thing going on, which I'm still wrapping my head around. Beautiful looking book. Lawrence Campbell did a lot of Dark Horse work for Mike Mignola. I would briefly say, check that out. I have some thoughts, but I need to get a little further on that. But I would still say I know enough. You also have Tom Mueller on design. So check it out. But my book for this week is, I'm pretty excited for Alien Black, White, and Blood number 3. I recently read Black, White, and Blood number 1, I think yesterday or the day before, so I have some thoughts on this. Obviously, as I've mentioned in the past, this is an anthology series surrounding the Aliens universe. I don't know if this structure is going to be the same for every single issue, but in this issue, you have a multi-part story. You get the first part of the multi-part story, and then you get a pair of one-shots that follow. The multi-part story is being written by Colin Kelly and Jackson Lansing. That's called Utopia, with art by Michael Dowling, colors by Chris Sotomayor. And in this issue, you have a pair of one-shots, the first being The Hunt, written by Stephanie Phillips, art by Marcelo Ferreira, colors by Pete Pentazis. And you have Maternal Instinct, written by Ryan Cady, art by Devmalia Promenik. Honestly, I was convinced when I sat down to read this and What If Aliens this weekend that this book was actually going to be the weaker of the two. After reading both, I can actually say I'm pretty optimistic about both, which in some ways is kind of a more monumental victory for this book because it's an anthology book that sure. has so many multiple parts that it's juggling, and there's just multiple opportunities for something to inevitably fall flat. But it doesn't. It is a little weird to see Kelly and Lansing, who are currently the architects of IDW's lauded 2022 Star Trek reboot, which landed the franchise's first ever Eisner nomination last year for Best New Series. It's a little odd to see them helming this multi-part anthology story for an Aliens franchise, but I suppose it's not as like jarring as if they were trying to like juggle Star Trek and Star Wars. And those things can coexist, people, but like, I expect Marvel would be like, yeah, we can't have you doing that shit.
Sure.
So I'll briefly talk about the Utopia story, because obviously this is the multi-part story that is carrying through to the other ones. It's actually really good, and it surrounds the spaceship, which is helmed by the citizens of the Union of Progressive Peoples, which is a government organization you really don't see that much in the films. Mm-hmm. You really don't see it in the main high-profile media of the Aliens franchise. It comes up in some of the books. It comes up in the role-playing content, but it's not front and center. Maybe that's because it's a socialist interstellar superpower in the future, which is led by Germany, Spain, and Russia. It rivals the United Americas and the Three World Empire. We all know all of this. This is like, obviously, everyone knows this. So, like I said, kind of interesting to see them, mainly because the two things that you really see front and center are the United Americas and Weyland-Yutani and kind of their evil, sinister collaborations. The UPP was actually a big part of William Gibson's 1987 screenplay of Alien 3 before that was passed on.
Interesting.
Which makes sense. It's written in 87. It was very much a Cold War allegory. William Gibson wrote a really great script. Gibson, famous for the book Neuromancer, and they passed on it. But Dark Horse actually did an adaptation of that screenplay a couple years back before they had to hand the Alien franchise over to Marvel. So if you're interested in that, you can check it out. Point being, this is the first story I've seen that really focuses around the UPP since then. They find, quote, a corporatist ship far from its normal exploitation grounds and damaged beyond repair with a faint sign of life inside it, a single survivor, and they choose to investigate. There you go. We all know maybe where that will go. Michael Dowling's art, though, absolutely stellar. I'd never heard of this guy before. Michael Dowling. Apparently he drew most of Vertigo's Unfollowed, with Rob Williams, which ran from 2016 to 2017. Unsurprising given that Williams connection, he's also drawn several strips for 2000 AD and Judge Dredd magazine.
Of course. Again,
what would you expect? He just uses this wide just gradations of gray. There's a charcoal light look of smudges and kind of speckling to the book that give the worn, grimy feel it needs. And his thin line work really shines because there really isn't that much color in the book. There's some green, there's some red. The end.
Well, that doesn't sound like black, white, and blood, if you ask me. Yeah, so, yeah. Like, what are they doing with the conceit of this series? Yeah.
They're already breaking the rules. Issue one, right out of the gate. Expectations, just cast them aside.
Some creatures use a copper analog for hemoglobin, which renders their blood green instead of red. So,
damn it. All right.
Also, to be less stupid about it, aliens have green blood.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, exactly.
How human-centric of me.
Yeah. Check your anthropocentric privilege, Mike.
Okay, there's the episode title right there.
But I the main story is good, and so then the cynic in me was like, okay, so the one shots are gonna be shit. Let's just buckle in to be let down. And they're both really solid. Stephanie Phillips, The Hunt, kind of plays with a lot of those exploitative trophy hunting tourism things that you've seen in recent days, where people pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to go into some third world country and try to, you know, shoot some endangered species from like 3,000 yards away with a high powered rifle. It kind of riffs on that. There's a little Eat the Rich, which of course has been a popular theme in recent media because late stage capitalism.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, did you see Aliens? Because I'm pretty
sure. Yeah. To Aliens' credit, it's like, it's not. it's not inconsistent messaging. It's yeah. they've been kind of hitting at this for a while.
Literally that, eating the rich for 30 yeah, plus
yeah,
years.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Recent media. Yeah. Are you talking about the 20th century, 21st century? Yeah.
by popular media, do you mean the last 200 years? Oh god. But the other two stories are really solid. Maternal Instinct kind of gives you a story from the perspective of the mother computers. That's the MU-TH-UR computers that run everything, and they're just a little brother of HAL, basically, right? Mm-hmm. But maybe not. Overall, just really solid. I'm pretty excited for this next issue. Maybe if you want to be super cynical, maybe they front-loaded all the good shit in the first issue, and it's just shit from there. But
maybe it's possible though that Marvel is trying to put their best foot forward,
yeah,
and trying to tell good stories with the licenses that they have, because they know that they spent a shitload of money to acquire these licenses.
Yeah.
And okay, if it doesn't work out, Disney's going to be mad. Papa Walt is coming out of the freezer, all right? Like,
the mouse is gonna beat your ass the sack quarters.
Exactly.
Yeah, they took Steamboat Willie, but they're not gonna take this sitting down. Nope. I don't know if it's that they just feel like they've reached the limit of how much of this content they can put out, and just one book a month has just naturally meant that there's a good amount of quality control.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously there's two right now, but largely it's like one book a month. But no. Between this and the Predator book, I'm pretty impressed with things right now, which I believe is also Ed Brisson. So we'll just tie things back to Brisson while we're at it.
Yeah, but Nick's a happy boy.
Yeah,
you know, that's good to hear.
It's a weird place to be. It's a very weird, uncomfortable place to be.
Sure.
And we'll just see how they continue to handle these franchises.
But okay,
Brian, have you read this?
No, I haven't. I've got the first couple of issues, but I haven't actually gotten around to reading them yet.
Okay, I would be very, very curious to hear your thoughts on this.
We'll have to do another alien-centric episode in the future. Yeah. That's what it sounds like to me. Marvel's, like, maybe taking a look at Marvel's, like, entire run on this alien series or franchise now that they've, like, had full control over it for a couple of years. Because I think there's a lot to be said. But before we get into that, let me talk about a book that I have on the top of my pile. That is Mountain. This is a Kickstarter book that I just literally just got in the mail yesterday. It's by Emily Reisbach and Bitmap Prager. It's a story. The summary of that they give on Kickstarter is this. A mousy pilgrim trudges through an overgrown square, tiny attendants skittering underfoot, ferrying hunks of old stone and any other scrap they could salvage. Vines crawl in the structures around her, an entire ecosystem built on what was left behind by those who came before, if you believe the stories. So this is kind of like an open-ended book about what appears to be like a little mouse and a little like grasshopper person, and they're kind of like going through the world. And you know, who isn't a sucker for a little story about a fantasy world where a mouse is the main character, right? From what I understand, there's a lot of like emotional baggage that these two carry that we have to like unpack as the story goes on. It's a little one-shot story that came out from this publisher called Cow House Press, but originally it was put together on Kickstarter. I was looking through my emails to be like, oh, when did this actually get fulfilled? Because I thought I saw a message about it like late last year. It turns out it was supposed to be released in April of 2022. So the Kickstarter was probably like end of 2021, early 2022. And it just arrived at my house this past weekend. I remember, like I said, I got a message about this on Kickstarter through Kickstarter, like at the middle of last year, saying like, hey, update your address. And I did. And I was like, cool, this will probably be here. But like, I don't know, a Kickstarter shows up, I fill out my information, I go, it'll be here one day. Let's just hope I don't move in that time, right? Because that's happened a couple times. But yeah, it arrived in the mail. It looks really, really cute. I have it right next to me. Hold on.
You know what the art reminds me a lot of is, and I can't remember who did the art on this, but what was the name of that Simon Spurrier book? The Spiral?
The Spire.
Spire.
The Spire.
Yeah.
Yes.
I got this here. I mean, if you're watching this on Patreon folks get access to full video episodes. But I've got this nice little book. It's actually very big and it's really thick. It's much bigger than I thought it was going to be. I don't know why. I just assume a lot of these one shots are like 24, 36 pages. You kind of pay a little bit of money extra for them, but yeah, they're usually very high quality prints. And like when you're supporting small press, like the cost of a comic kind of varies, you know, compared to mass produced comic yeah. books, but mm-hmm. that's a whole other thing. Yeah, I don't know. I'm excited to read this. I really, really have enjoyed a lot of the Kickstarter books that I've been reading lately because I've made this big goal for this year to read a lot more of the stuff that's just in my Kickstarter digital folder, as well as what's on my shelf. And like, for the most part, it's all been really good. And I'm like glad that I made these choices for myself. I just don't know why I put off reading these books for so long. So I'm excited to read this. I know a lot of people on Kickstarter, like if you go to the Kickstarter page, you can see a lot of people are very mad at how delayed this book is. But I'm of the opinion that like small press, like comics in general are really, really hard to make. And like when you're just a person and or a handful of people trying to put something like this out, like there really should be a lot more patience around this. I don't think I need to necessarily defend this Kickstarter or really any Kickstarter, but like my thought process is like I put in my information. I know that Kickstarter is not a store. There really is no guarantee for anything. Although comics have kind of established this like money in, comic out situation. Because I think there is, again, the misconception about, quote, how easy it is to make a comic book and get the comic book out. And especially with so many of these comics coming to the Kickstarter with the book mostly finished or mostly written or partially completed, people just kind of assume, oh, that means they just need the money. Then it'll pop out of the imaginary, like, oven of where this comic book is made. But like I think the thing that people don't understand is like there is a lot of folks have a lot of high quality expectations and a lot of like just like issues with the publication of comics. We've talked about it on our Discord a lot because we have a couple comic creators over there. And a lot of people have worked with Kickstarters or have been around and using Kickstarter for years to support comics. Like there are so many things that can go wrong in the process. And the fact that you get your comics from your comic book publisher is just because it is a well-oiled machine. And when you're an independent creator, like there are so many things that can go wrong just because you do not have the sway that like Marvel or DC or Image or Boom or whoever does because of years and years of established relationships. So I don't know. I always have a lot of leniency. I was happy to get this book. Again, it's a very good looking book. And honestly, I'm happy to at least have just gotten the digital comic book because that has been out for a little bit. It's just the printing took forever. So all that to be said is I'm very excited to read this book called Mountain. It looks really cute. And of course, like I said, you got a mouse on the cover. You've sold me. You don't really have to tell a great story. I'm in it. So anyways, I hope this is going to be good. Cowhouse Press. I don't remember if I've read anything else from them, but this book looks cute. So this should be pretty fun.
I do have a question about this process, Mike. And I'm aware that this question could definitely fall down a rabbit hole of thoughts. So feel free to, you know, curtail that if you want. Mm-hmm. I know I don't, but maybe you will.
okay.
If obviously you talk about Kickstarter books a lot that you're interested in that have shown up at your house, blah, blah, blah. When listeners hear that, you know, hear that a book that clicks or resonates with them and they want to purchase that book, be that physical or digital, what are the purchasing opportunities, generally speaking? Can you go to a Kickstarter page on a Kickstarter that's been funded and try to get your hands on a book? Do you have to go hunt down the author's, I don't know, personal shop? Like what are the options at that point?
Yeah. So sometimes it depends. It really depends on the Kickstarter creator. Sometimes they'll say, hey, this is only for Kickstarter and it's never going to come out again. Sometimes, like for instance, this book, Mountain, if you wanted to buy it, you can actually go to the Cowhouse Press website and you can buy it. We'll put links to all this stuff in the show notes. And that being said, usually when we're talking about Kickstarter books on the show, there's usually links in the show notes. So if there's anything you know you're interested in, just look for those in the show notes for the show. But yeah, usually if you go to the Kickstarter page, they'll have a link to the like website where you can go buy it, or link to someone's Itch or someone's, you know, Gumroad or whatever that may be where they're selling that comic, because that's what Kickstarter encourages you to do, to say like, hey, use the Kickstarter page now to click people out to wherever they may be able to buy the book in the future, or whatever. So most of the time there's a digital edition available for like 95% of the comics, I think, that I've read and talked about on the show. In the rare cases, there aren't. I mean, like usually you have to reach out to the artist or the creator, or there's a physical edition that you can buy. So yeah, it all depends. But like I said, 95% of the time they have a link that takes you out to where you can buy it after the fact. So or if you're Quindary Press, for some reason, you only publish your little 48-page zines as part of other Kickstarters in the future. That's a whole other thing. But I don't know. It doesn't matter. But before I go into that rabbit hole any further, Brian, what is on the top of your pile so we can wrap up this show?
Well, much like Nick, I am also going to fall squarely into the pigeonhole you created for me.
Okay.
Because I read a Star Wars book, or I'm going to read a Star Wars book. And this is also
contain multitudes, but not today.
Not today. This is also a weird coincidence because I'm going to read Darth Vader, Black, White, and Red. I promise I didn't do that on purpose. Okay. I picked it, and okay, then I opened the note doc and saw Nick's. So I was like, well, god damn it. So this is also an anthology book centered around Darth Vader, obviously. I think that's cool because I think that there are a lot of different ways that the character of Darth Vader has been and can be portrayed. And I think it's very interesting to see like what direction an artist or a writer wants to go. I did not list any creators on this book because there are 12 short stories in this volume. And
whoa, okay.
That's just too many names. And I didn't want to just like randomly pick five people to attribute. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry. It's a lot.
Well, he must have had a favorite, right, Brian? He must
I haven't read it yet, Nick. It's top of my pile.
Yeah, okay. I figured by now you had already sort of like, I'm like, this is the one.
No, I'm not going to cheat like that.
this isn't last week's show where me and Kate definitely read chunks of the books we talked about.
But I think it's interesting to see like who is gonna do like sad boy Anakin is still in there somewhere Darth Vader versus who is gonna do, you know, all I am surrounded by is fear and dead men, like killing machine Darth Vader.
Who's gonna do the end of Rogue One Darth Vader?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Terrifying badass Darth Vader. This book is also just using black and white and then shades of red for its art. I did flip through a little bit just to get a look at that to make sure it was actually doing that before I said this on the show.
Yeah.
But it does look very cool. Just seeing like the different ways different artists and colorists like go into different shades of red and like how they use them, especially how they use like the red of his lightsaber to light things, because I'm sure that's where like this black, white, and red came from.
Star Wars really doesn't have a lot of blood in it, right?
Yeah.
Mike, it can't because lightsabers cauterize wounds.
they do after the first movie when Obi-Wan cut that, that spider guy's arm off.
Yeah.
Ponda Boba loses his there's blood all over the floor. Didn't the Star Wars community fucking lose their brain trying to like justify that at one point?
Probably. The Star Wars community has lost its brain about almost everything.
Obi-Wan's lightsaber operates at a lower frequency. I don't remember, but they found a way to explain.
Let him talk about his comic book, please.
Sorry. You just unlocked a memory, Brian. I apologize.
I said Nick's sleeper agent trigger phrase. No, I think it's cool. Like the black and white aspect is also really cool to me because I think Star Wars is historically like a very black and white good versus evil story.
Yeah.
So I think that's just like an interesting connection, and I'm kind of wondering how intentional that was versus how much is that just me completely overreading this idea. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I love a good Star Wars, and I love a story that takes me 3 minutes to read because that's about how long my attention span is these days. So I think this is going to be a great combo for me.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah, dude.
Brian, have you read Visions while we're on the topic of Star Wars anthology books? Have you delved into that at all?
I watched the first season of Visions on Disney Plus, but I haven't read the comics.
Okay. I'm exactly the reverse. I've read the comics. I haven't seen the show. The book is pretty interesting.
I just want a 90-minute movie of the samurai Sith. That's all that I want. And I know that they made comics.
Book.
Yeah. I know there's a comic.
Yeah.
I just want that. But more to say, I guess, maybe in the post-credits. But we're going to wrap up the show here. I want to say thanks to Brian and Nick for this episode. Thanks to Kate for proof listening. Next week's show is going to be Zach, Kate, and I. We're going to be talking about crowdfunded comics, probably more of stuff like Mountain and other things, in celebration of Kickstarter's 15th anniversary. So that should be really, really fun. We're all going to read a bunch of Kickstarter and crowdfunded comics and then talk about them. So make sure you tune in next week. But until next time, comics are good, and so are you.